Part of the Boundless Audio Podcast Network.
So things look bad and your rights are at risk. The patriarchy seems triumphant. The world's as gooey as some rotten lutefisk. Can't cope with hopelessness so constant. You've lost your way. You're feeling real depressed. But if I may please interject, you're a feminist, baby. A goddamn feminist, baby. You're a no-shit-talking badass bitch. You're a feminist just like me. You're a boss queen, baby. A rad fever dream who's bravely fighting inequality. You're a feminist just like me. Welcome to another episode of Whining About Herstory, the Women's History Podcast, where two besties with breasties whine about women from history that you haven't heard of, but def should have, and make parodies out of has-been hotel songs that they are currently binge listening to.
I was like, why does that sound vaguely familiar?
I've
also never seen, like, I know of has-been hotel, but I've never actually watched it.
So the original pilot came out for it like 4 years ago, and the creator's been trying to get it off the ground forever. Mm-hmm. And it finally got picked up by Amazon Prime and came out. And so my friend and friend of the podcast, Jory, what's up? Who this is dedicated to. I'm going to be like, you just have to listen to this. Just like, here's the episode number. Just fucking listen to it. You're going to love it. But she and I watched it together, and it's a musical animated adult comedy. Like, yeah. It's so good. It, you know, tackles the issues of like heaven and hell and redemption and what it means to be a good person and like this and that. And it's got some great great songs. And, Loser Baby is one of them where it's like, yeah, we're all fucking losers, but maybe together we can get through it. So I did a parody off of that. Aww. Because it's been stuck in my head for a month now.
Nice.
So anyone who's into that, I hope they're freaking out right now. Anyone who has no idea, I hope you just enjoyed it anyway.
I did.
I'm glad. I worked on it. A rhyming dictionary was involved. Sometimes I'm like on my way over here and something pops into my head and I workshop it on like the 5 minute drive. This I fucking worked on. I workshop this on
You're
the
like,
computer.
I want to do this. How do I do this?
Oh my God. Well, thank you so much for joining us for another episode.
Yeah.
I'm drinking some body armor lights because hydration is key to being able to get up the next morning and be a functional person when you're in your 30s.
Yay. Getting older.
Getting older, getting bolder. All the creeks are cracking closer. Closer?
There you go.
I don't know.
It's like all the creeks are cracking closer.
Getting older, getting bolder. The darkness creeps in closer.
There you go.
See, that's the kind of shit I come up with on my way here. Kelly, what are you drinking?
I am drinking the rest of the wine from last week's episode, Misfits and Mavens.
You can't let this go to waste. It's so good.
So good.
It's so fucking good. I would buy this again. I would 100% buy this again. I love it so much. Just for the bottle. I would buy this for people.
No, like, yeah, this would be a good gift.
Well, and it wasn't super expensive. Like, you know how much of a cheap bitch I am when it comes to
good,
wine.
Like mid-tier wine. Maybe not mid-tier.
100%.
Low mid-tier wine.
And here's the thing. I feel like it's one of those things where, like, even if you're not super into it, you appreciate the thought that went behind it because it's the label. And I'm sorry, I'm clinking a bunch of glasses so I can take a picture.
Emily just stole my wine.
To take a picture, and now I'm giving it back, so calm the fuck down.
I refuse to calm
You're
down.
You're so hysterical right now. How dare you feel feelings?
I have a friend that always, I guess he hasn't said it a lot lately, but he always used to say, like, calm your tits. And I would always be like, I'm only going to calm one of them.
I will calm one of my tits. The other tit will not be tamed.
The other one's just too crazy.
The other tit will not be tamed. Oh, I fucking love it. Well, Kelly, you have the pleasure of going for... Oh, wait. We have to cheers to something. We have to cheers.
Cheers to.
Well, okay. By the time we're recording this, it is before a very significant event. But hopefully by the time this episode comes out,
this will be the Monday after.
It will be a successful...
I mean, it was last time.
Event. I think... Okay, so we got invited back to the Olmsted County History Center to do a live show for Women's History Month. We're also doing a live spot on the local news, and I'm definitely not nauseous. It's great. It's awesome.
Like, the only thing that's making me feel better about the live spot on the news is I'm like... I haven't watched any of them, but they're super short. It's like 2 to 3 minutes.
100%.
And I'm like, all right. I can do that.
It's not a big deal. Yeah.
And they apparently sent Emily a questionnaire that I'm unaware of what the questions were.
It was very basic. It was not opinion based. It was like, no, what are you?
I assume that's what like the questions on air are going to be similar to. And so I'm like, great, Emily's prepared. I have no fucking idea.
Yeah, so by our next episode, you're going to know if this was a success or not. But, like, cheers to us doing well.
Yeah.
Question mark?
Women's History Month.
And Women's History Month.
The time of year everyone asks us to do shit.
Yeah, the time of year that people actually remember we exist. Mm-hmm. Like, wait, did I know someone who's, like, into women's history?
Yeah. It both feels great and kind of bad at the same time.
I mean, I think it was within our first or second year, Bustle mentioned us in an article for Women's History Month.
Yeah, and we haven't been mentioned since. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's just a thing.
Probably.
I'll take it.
I will too.
I'll fucking take it. I'll take it all. Give it to me.
Oh, governor.
Oh, governor. God, fuck. Oh, governor.
Right in the verjourner.
Right in the verjourner.
We're just going to combine all the
Jesus Christ. If you're not part of the funerary cult, you need to join because we got really into virginal hearth in our last episode, which...
Emily did a wonderful happening on... ads targeting women
and
like the problems it creates.
It's a lot, but it's also insane. Wonderful. I made Kelly like throw her head back laughing. So hopefully you enjoy it as much as she did.
All right, should we dive in?
Was it good for you? It was good for me.
Good for me.
Did you laugh?
Like a good full belly,
like a
head
good
thrown back laugh.
Oh,
tears
you,
in the eyes.
When I can make Kelly throw her head back and curl her toes, I know I've done my job. Well, Kelly, you're going first.
This has gotten weird.
You're going
like
first, thankfully.
Less than 10 minutes into the episode.
I'm just going to say, Kelly, we've gotten weirder. Oh, you 100%. Know we've gotten weirder.
Again, this goes back to what we talked about last episode. And I was like, this is why we don't let people we know professionally... listen.
Oh, 100%.
Not let them, but hope that they
we
don't.
We do not. We actively discourage.
And people are like, oh, yeah, I've heard you had a podcast. Yep. End of conversation. Like,
it was super fun
end
when
of
Kelly.
Conversation.
It was super fun when Kelly was doing her master's, and her like fun fact about her is that she has a women's history podcast every time. And then every time she's like, but,
I have
like,
regrets.
Don't fucking listen to it.
Yeah. Like, I need to find something else in my life that's a fun fact.
I mean, this is fun.
No, it
is. It is a fact.
I just don't want other people.
It's maybe not a proud fact.
I know, it's a weird double line because I'm like, I want people to listen and, like, learn about these women. But I don't want them to see that side of me.
There's definitely a difference, like, with the professional line versus people you meet randomly, your friends, things like that. Yeah. Like, when I first started doing
that. Well, like, if I ever get a client that's like, oh, I've listened to your podcast, I will probably die on the inside.
That's when you say, I'm so sorry, I can't help you, yeah. Let me refer you to someone else.
Let me refer you to somebody else.
Let me refer you to someone who you have, who you don't have access to 5 years of their bullshit. But like when I was doing the Hinge thing at first, I didn't tell people what the podcast was called. But then I was like, if they're not into the podcast, I shouldn't be dating them.
Yeah, exactly.
And like they don't have to be like a regular listener. But if they're like, I don't like this bitch on the podcast, then they need to go fuck themselves.
Right, like, if you can't handle me at the podcast level, you can't handle, you don't deserve me.
You can't handle me, period. Yeah, which I got really lucky because my fellow not only regularly listens, but he's a funerarian.
My husband's just our IT guy.
He does a lot. He does a lot of work. He's helping me buy a new computer so I can stop dealing with my almost 20-year-old piece of shit. All right. So, Kelly, who are you whining about today?
I am whining about Samira Musa.
Samira Musa. All right.
I like the name Samira.
I do like that too. I feel, was that a TV show or a movie? I feel like Samira.
She's not on our list of people we've covered.
So No. It's not that, but Samira, I can almost.
Yeah, it sounds like vaguely hear it. Familiar. Yeah.
Lovely name.
I know when you Google it, like, there's a bunch of like Instagram influencers and stuff with the name. So it could be like something like that too.
Okay. Because I'm very up to date on the Instafluencers.
Well, there's a really famous Indian actress or former actress named Samira.
Okay.
So that could be potentially it.
All right. Well, let's talk Samira.
So, yeah. I'm going to start this off very similar to like your last story that like there's not a lot of records, like actual records of her life. So it's a lot of secondhand accounts, some are
family
rumors,
family lore,
or like very official documents where there's not much of a story, but it's like she was definitely here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just want to say that like this was one of those stories that there weren't a lot of sources, and it was a lot of sources just repeating the same thing over and over and over again.
Which is the nature of our podcast covering lesser known women or more obscure women.
And so. I'm just saying, like, sometimes, like my like Emily last week, I found a lot of different sources that had different information. And this was one, yeah, where it was like one person wrote something.
And then it was like copied
all
and pasted.
That's on there. There's a few, like, there's a few things at like the end of her story that like, yeah, there's a few different versions out there that I'll talk about. But so I don't know if we have any Egyptian listeners.
Listeners?
I'm sorry. You're making me drink your wine. I've had so much wine.
Here's the thing. Don't apologize. Drinking wine and slurring is part of our shtick. And honestly, we don't do it as much as you'd think we do.
We need to do it more.
We need to get wasted a lot more. My liver could really use the exercise. I just don't want to be a candidate for organ harvesters. I want them to look at me and be like, not that bitch.
Yes, yes, yes. No.
Oh, bitch. No. Fuck no.
No, just get her out of here. I can't even look at her.
She's basically a pickled corpse. Don't even worry about it.
Oh, someone wants pickled liver? Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
Anyways. So I don't know if we have any Egyptian listeners that maybe this story is more well known. But this is what I have. So if other people know this story and are like, well, that's not accurate, this is what I could find in the amount of digging that we do on this podcast. Okay. So Samira was born in Egypt in 1917. So like one of my first facts is like a contested fact, which is interesting. But her mom died from cancer at some point in her life. A lot of sources said earlier in life. Some sources said it was why she was like in college.
Mm-hmm.
So we know her mom died from cancer. At what point is a little contested.
Okay.
Her father was Musa Ali, or probably Ali Musa, depending, you know, like, I think in Egypt they tend to say the last name first.
Yep.
And he was allegedly a famous political activist. Again, this was something in, like, depending on what source you looked at, people were like, he was a political activist. And sometimes it was just like, nope, he was just a dude. Are you trying not to laugh at me?
We have 100% covered this woman before.
Have we?
I'm pretty sure. Is she a physicist?
She's a nuclear physicist.
Did she die in a car crash?
Yeah. She wasn't on our list.
God, she was dead.
Well, then, it finally happened.
No, no, no. Here's the thing. The cancer thing, where I was like, this is sounding a little familiar. So I looked up a picture of her. I think we should still tell her story.
I mean, no, if we have covered her, I'm not doing it. I think I have another one.
Oh my God.
Now I have to look for it.
Okay. Okay. We're going to take a break. Kelly's going to find her other story. And then I'm going to find the episode number.
That's what I'm doing right now.
Where we cover Samira Musa. Because her story is really incredible. And like, even I remember details about it. Unfortunately, I spoiled the ending. She's fucking amazing.
157, you covered her.
150. Wait, I covered her? Mm-hmm. Oh, shit. Jesus Christ. I totally thought you covered
her. Nope, you covered her.
Oh, my God.
I must not have looked at our list when I covered that one, so
this
I apologize.
Is the most amazing thing. Can I just say, it has been 5 years. We have had
the first time it's happened.
Several near misses, but we have never actually tried to cover the same person twice like this. And I totally forgot that I covered her. Honestly, that's probably why I remembered so much about her.
Yeah, you're like, this sounds vaguely familiar.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Okay.
So what was it again? Episode 157?
157.
Okay. So go back and listen to episode 157 to learn about Samira Musa. I kind of wanted to hear your take on it, but we can always talk later. So, yeah, we're going to take a break, and we're going to
hopefully
pivot.
I have another story.
We're going to pivot. That's great. Honestly, Samira deserves a lot more attention. Long story short, she was a physicist. She dealt with, like, atomic radiation, incredibly intelligent, did nuclear research. She was a pioneer.
Well, she was very much all about how, you know what? Fine. I'll just tell her story anyways.
Yeah. Let's do it because
it's still relevant. I don't have to find someone else.
Yeah. This is Kelly's take.
I am so sorry, first of all.
Okay. So remember cassette tapes? This is the other side of the cassette tape.
This is the B side. Now I'm like, itching to go like look at your notes for it, and I won't until after. And maybe you can, we can kind of tag team it. And I'm sorry. Like, so for our listeners, you can kind of just skip to the midway point of this episode and listen to whoever Emily's covering.
Honestly, okay. Can I just say, I can almost guarantee we are more drunk now than when I covered Samira.
Definitely.
So, okay, you know what's funny? I was like, why does that name sound so familiar?
There we go.
We fucking covered.
I feel so bad because normally I'm like super on top of it.
You know what's funny is Kelly is the only person who actually tracks who we've covered.
You know, I have it on a shared thing in our drive.
I just sense who we've covered and who we haven't. I just go with it. Kelly, I love you so much.
No, I'm so mad now at myself. Like,
here's the thing. One of the cool things about covering obscure women is that you hear about them once and sometimes you don't always remember everything. And episode 157 was, it's been a minute. So I want to hear your interpretation. I want to hear you tell Samira's story. And honestly, like Egyptian women in STEM, we have not covered a lot of them. I think that Samira deserves another go.
I would probably feel more ashamed if I hadn't drank as much as I have.
This is the Kelly remix.
Emily's like, here, finish my wine because I need to drive home. I'm like, okay.
I just want to say, you did this story before I gave you any fucking wine, so do not blame me, okay? You were stone cold sober when you did this.
I know. Okay, ready?
Yes, let's do it.
Father, allegedly a famous political activist, maybe, maybe not. He would move with his daughter to Cairo and open a small hotel business, which I was like, that's kind of interesting. And then, like, I couldn't find anything else about it, but also apparently he opened a school with, like, a friend of his.
I love that there was a time where you could just, like, I'm a hope. I'm an. Oh, Jesus Christ.
I'm a hoping.
I'm a hoping a hotel. Oh. I'm a shopping a shul.
Yeah, like, well, it does. It makes me wonder, like, because I didn't look much into her dad, because we tend not to do that.
Well, and I see two things. The hotel is a business. It's income. You know, his wife may have passed away at this point. That makes sense. A school, though, would be in line with his activism and supporting education and knowing where Samira ends up. Education was obviously something that was important to him and instilled in her. So it does make sense.
Yeah. I mean, and clearly, like, he had money from something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't know, like, what he was involved in other than, like, allegedly political activism. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, like, clearly, if you're going to, like, own or invest in a hotel, you have, like, that money is coming from somewhere.
Well, and hotels, like, here's the thing. They can make a lot of money, but the margins are also very narrow.
Exactly. Like, so clearly, to be able to do this, like, her dad must have done something else other than just activism.
Yeah, but we don't know. But all we need to know is that he had a hotel and supported his family, and he also opened a school, and good for him.
Yeah, so she would attend Kaiser El-Shak Primary School, which is one of the oldest, like, primary schools in Cairo.
Mm-hmm.
And then after she completed her primary education, she would go to the Banat Al-Ashraf School, which is the one built and managed, some sources said, like, by her dad and another person. Some people said just by her dad. Her dad was somehow involved with this school.
Was that maybe the one that he opened up?
Yeah, I think he built and managed it in some capacity. But, like, mm-hmm. whether or not it was just him is kind of what was up for debate.
I can't imagine he was the only person running that school.
No,
period,
probably so. Not. Especially depending on, like, what the school was for. Like, if it was, a general school, yeah, no way it was just him.
Yeah. He's got a hotel to run. He's busy.
He's busy. So Samira, there we go, would achieve high grades in secondary education and could have pursued a career in probably anything she wanted to. A lot of the sources were like, oh, she was going to pursue a course in engineering. So I kind of wonder if her dad was maybe, like, an engineer or something, especially since a lot of the sources were like, he built the school. Mm. And so I'm like, maybe he was an engineer. And so that's why it was assumed she would follow in her father's footsteps and go into engineering. But basically, she could have pursued almost any career she wanted because she was just one of those people that's, like, naturally talented and got really good grades in, like, every subject. She, however, chose to join the sciences. She would go into radiology specifically and would obtain a BSc in radiology with first class honors.
I just came up with something.
Yep.
Hashtag STEMFEM.
Nice.
Love it. That was a good one.
That is a good one.
That was actually a good one. Yeah. I know you weren't feeling cock of the walk, but that was a good one.
I like STEMFEM.
STEMFEM. Yep. Hashtag STEMFEM.
So she would, receive her Bachelor of Science in Radiology with first class honors. Particularly, she would research the effects of X-ray radiation on various materials. So not even on, like, people necessarily, but, like, how X-rays in general affect different things.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. It's one of those things we've talked about before that, like, we never think about, like, who chose to study something. And I'm like, okay, yeah, like, studying how X-rays affect things makes a lot of sense, because you think about, like, even when it comes to, like, secondary radiation of the techs that are in the room or stuff like that. Like,
or materials in the room.
Yep.
Yeah.
Knowing how they're affected can be really important because, yeah, if you're, like, using, you know, a certain stone that maybe, like, absorbs but then, like, readmits that radiation, that's going to be very harmful.
I will say, like, I don't have the scientific acumen to process those studies, but the idea of studying the way X-ray radiation affects different materials, I think that sounds super interesting.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, it's not, like, for me, but it's interesting. Yeah. Exactly. So she couldn't have picked a better field during that time frame. So this is the 1930s. This is when X-rays were really becoming, like, a mainstream, quote-unquote, popular thing. This is when, like, hospitals, each hospital starting to have like their own x-ray machine instead of, you know, like maybe one hospital in a given county or something.
Like now we take for granted that you can get an x-ray wherever you go. But at this time it was like air conditioning where it started becoming popular and commonplace.
Exactly. And so like, yeah, this is like the perfect time to be doing it. Also, I think about like, this is the perfect time to be doing it so that these facilities that are being built are safe. You know what I mean?
It's actually a really good point because, nowadays x-ray techs, they stand behind that, like, special wall. Yep.
There's lead plating and, like, all of this stuff.
And can you imagine back in the day, they were just, like, there was fucking radiation all over the place. It was just an embarrassment of radiation. X-rays all over the place. Triple X-rays.
Bouncing everywhere.
It was triple X-rated. NSFW.
Oh, the way down.
All the way down, bigger and blacker than ever. Like the Cards Against Humanity box.
Right.
I'm not trying to be weird.
Yeah, you kind of
are. I mean, I'm trying to be weird by making a reference to something specific that's not inherently offensive.
So, like others before, like a lot of people that have studied radiation in general, Samira would study radioactive isotopes used to create medical images. So, like, specifically, you think of, like, when you go in to get an x-ray. That is not the only thing x-rays are used for.
Yes, it is.
It's just like you're very like stone cold. Like, yeah, it is.
Tell me what else they're used for.
X-ray.
Exactly.
Ouch. No, I mean, kidding. Like you think of the at airports, that's an x-ray.
Microwaves.
Anyways, but like she would study those too. And her PhD work in those radioactive isotopes would catch the work of Cairo University's chair of science and dean of faculty, Dr. Mustafa Musharrafa. And he believed in, like, her work and her intelligence so much that he was like, hey, you should lecture at the college.
Loving this.
Which wasn't done before. She became the first assistant professor and the first woman to hold a university post. And I have a caveat in this. I literally have like an asterisk. Because because none of the sources like were specific. They weren't like, oh, in this school. But I did a lot of digging. And I was like, okay, it's either in Egypt or specifically at that school. I'm not sure which one. Because the first woman to hold a university post and, like, get paid to teach at a university was in 1239. And I've covered at least two women prior to this that have taught at universities.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, people need to be more specific in their thing. So I have it starred, and I think it's in Egypt. I couldn't find anyone else. And it could just be at this college, and I don't know of any other Egyptian university professors prior to this.
Regardless, it was a big deal.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It was a super huge deal. And she was
kind of a big deal.
She was the first Egyptian woman to have obtained a PhD in atomic radiation. So that definitely is a thing.
That's so wild. I mean, anyone getting a PhD in atomic radiation and at this time is wild to me. But
the fact that it's like the 1940s and So
I mean, this was peak time for atomic radiation.
And there is another extra little thing I want to add in general, it was nearly impossible for women to obtain PhDs in general, because in Egypt at the time, a lot of the universities were still dominated by either the British or other foreign entities.
Ooh.
And so a lot of the faculty were British or other foreign nationalities. So the fact that she not only earned her PhD, but then when it was able to step on and become a faculty member is huge.
Yeah.
Like, so she didn't only just have the barrier of like being a woman. She had the barrier of being a woman in her own country, but in a country that was owned by other countries.
An Egyptian woman. Also a woman of color, period.
Yeah.
Colonization is rooted in racism and sexism. What's up?
Yep. So thanks to her, like, thankfully, like, she was, like, once she got into her position, like, she was very not necessarily welcomed, but like respected.
She was successful.
Yeah. People were like, damn, she's smart. You know, like there's a reason that she did get accepted and that she was able to complete her PhD, and people recognized that. To the point where she was actually invited, and then she chose to travel to the UK in about the mid-1940s, where she would finish her PhD. While she was in the UK, she would collaborate with other researchers to advance a lot of her knowledge in physics, and she would actually come up with the historic equation that would break atoms into cheaper material, or sorry. Basically...
It's been a lot of wine tonight.
No, it's not even that. This sentence I wrote, I must have wrote it in a hurry because it like doesn't quite make sense. Give me like 2 seconds.
I think I remember this part, but basically, okay. Yeah. Okay, you got it?
Yeah, okay. I literally just omitted a word. Basically, she came up with a historic equation that helped break atoms of cheap materials. That's of cheap materials like such as copper, which therefore makes x-rays and other things, you know, using that technology that much cheaper because copper is so much more widely available than uranium or any of these other metals that they were using that were are a lot more expensive.
Right. So which then influences how widely available x-ray technology is, because you can actually use more affordable and more accessible materials to replicate the same effects.
Exactly.
Awesome.
And that was exactly her goal, is she wanted to make x-rays and particularly cancer treatments that much more accessible and affordable. And so, yeah, most of her research, particularly when she was in the UK, focused on ways to make nuclear energy, particularly medical applications of nuclear energy, better for patients, whether that is shortening the patient x-ray exposure time, making sure x-rays are more portable and like mobile, and all of these different things. And I'm guessing a lot of it is motivated by the fact that her mom died from cancer.
I was going to say, all of this kind of feels like a love letter to her mother. It feels very much that she was inspired by her earlier experiences. Because I think I remember she had some health issues when she was young that she struggled with. And then her mom died of cancer. So like her caring about people's health and their treatment and their accessibility to that was something that was very deeply rooted in her.
Yeah.
And her moral code early on.
Yeah. I didn't read anything about childhood illness, but it's one of those things.
Maybe I'm making it up.
Well, and I could have easily missed a source that maybe you
listen
found
to episode 153 and figure out what's going on.
I think it was 157.
Well, 150 something.
But yeah, one of the quotes from Samir that people like have attributed to her is that, yeah, quote, "My wish is for nuclear treatment of cancer to be as available and as cheap as aspirin." So like, yeah, she very much was like, I want to make it so anyone in the world can have this treatment if they need it.
So I just looked up what 157 is. And even if you remember this story, you definitely need to go back and listen to episode 157.
I don't know if I want to.
Because Kelly covered the silent killer teacher. Do you remember that one?
Mm-mm.
Okay, well, I do. And it was incredible. It was basically World War II threatened this teacher's students.
Oh,
and so
yeah,
she just went,
she
like,
was a badass.
She went fucking Rambo on the invading powers. And
I'm
then,
trying to remember if she lived on one of the islands. It might have been the Philippines.
I think it was. And then, yeah, it was Nieves Fernandez. And then, yeah, so it's the silent killer teacher and the mother of atomic energy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's do it.
I still feel bad for, I appreciate you letting me recover her, and I still feel bad.
Don't feel bad about it, because seriously, she deserves so much more attention than she's gotten.
Yeah. And then there was a more recent article that like literally attributed to her. It said, quote, Samira's research laid the groundwork for the revolution and the affordability and safety of nuclear medicine today. That was a 2022 article that actually like was like, hey, like, there's this woman that has been doing these, like, or that did these things.
Well, and think about how many people who have benefited from x-rays, from radiation treatment, and other methods of nuclear medicine. We all have either benefited from that or know someone who has.
Right.
And Samira was a huge part of that.
Yeah.
Just saying.
It makes me so mad that, like, she's not more well-known.
Yeah.
So not only was she, like, studying all these things and, like, doing all these things to advance the research, but throughout her life, Samira would also volunteer at a lot of the hospitals she was researching at to help treat cancer patients. And though she was mostly interested in promoting the medical advancements of nuclear energy, she was also very aware of the dangers that they posed.
And in the 1940s, when she's getting into all of this,
imagine
the moral and ethical components to nuclear technology were very, 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 very out there.
Oh, yeah. And so one of the other things she did while she was still abroad in the UK was to organize the Atomic Energy for Peace Conference. And basically, this was developed from her concern regarding the developments that she saw from the atomic weapons. And basically, she put a call out to the international community with the slogan Atoms for Peace. Which would actually eventually be part of Dwight D. Eisenhower's speech, which I'm like, did you steal that from her? But that's a whole other conversation. Yeah, did he cite her? But yeah, so she organized this thing that brought together all of these different countries, whether they were scientists or political people, you know, like trying to be like, guys, like, we need to recognize, because this is after the bombings in Japan.
Of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, yeah. Yep.
And so she's, you know, she's like, guys, like, we've seen the devastating effects. Like, we can't keep doing this.
Well, we have to regulate it. Like,
yeah.
Like, this isn't something that people can just have and use willy-nilly.
Yep.
Like, we've all seen the devastating power and effects that this can have. This can't just be something that people
use freely.
Yeah. Like, it has to be regulated.
Right.
This is a lot.
Yeah. And that is exactly what basically came out of this conference that she developed, was like, hey, guys, yeah, we need to organize some types of committees or advisory councils or something to not oversee, like, the industry and creation of these things, but also provide protection against these nuclear, potential nuclear threats, such as the use of atomic weapons.
Yeah. Like, you know. Something I don't think that we, in the year of our gods 2024, totally take into account. We grew up with media that has, like, big bombs and big explosions and devastation and stuff. And I don't think we fully appreciate the level of devastation that an atomic bomb can wreak.
I've read a lot.
Like, even, like, every time I read stuff about the atomic bombings of Japan, I always learn something new and absolutely horrifying. Like something that feels made up, like atomic shadows.
Oh, yeah. It's terrifying.
Absolutely insane. And I don't think that we fully appreciate the power and devastation that comes from that kind of technology. But people at this time had just witnessed it. Oh, yeah. And this was an entirely new level of unimaginable destruction. And the fact that she's like, we cannot let this destroy us, I think is really forward thinking.
Well, and also,
and really important.
One of the big things to remember is that the, I can't think of the name of it. The project that was
the Manhattan Project.
You. I was like, what is it? That was all done in secret. The until those bombs were dropped,
mm-hmm.
the public knew nothing about it.
Yep.
And so that was the other thing, is that not only is she trying to, because the conference that she did was public facing. Like, so she's like, okay, like, if like the development of nuclear stuff is very private, and I'm going to make it public because it needs to be public. Like, this needs to be regulated.
I think that's actually a really good point, because if you don't know what's happening until it's too late and it's already been used, how frightening is that?
Yeah. Well, and even a lot of scientists, unless they were in on the Manhattan Project, didn't know anything about the current atomic development.
Yeah.
Like, literally, it was in the hands of top officials and a very small group of scientists.
Yeah.
And she was like, okay, first of all, like, more people need to know about it because only having it with a select few of people is incredibly dangerous.
Because you're just
multiple levels.
Because you're just going to have the people who are like, yeah, let's drop the bomb, you know?
Exactly. And so, like, yeah, the fact that she was like, no, like, we're going to bring this to everyone is also a really big deal.
Well, and I think that's also a testament to the moral complications of inflicting that kind of destruction, because even the, I think it was the flight crew on the Enola Gay who dropped, was it Little Boy? I think it was the first atomic bomb.
Yeah, that was Little Boy.
When they saw that mushroom cloud, they were like, oh my God, what have we done?
Fuck, what did we just do?
What have we done?
Because they didn't know.
They didn't. And that was the point. Because if they knew the ramifications of what they were going to do, then that leads to questioning. And then that leads to the potential that the bomb isn't dropped.
Exactly.
You know? And I think that says a lot, where you have to keep the truth from the people that you're trusting to execute these kinds of things, because their morals might prevent them from following orders. And again, I don't want to get into a thing like, should we have dropped the bomb? Should we not have?
No, that's not what this is about.
I think regardless, you cannot deny the power and therefore the responsibility of this kind of technology. And I love that she's like, this cannot be in secret. We need to be regulating this. Yeah. And this can't be something that people are just like doing behind closed doors and no one knows about it until everyone's fucking dead.
Right. So yeah, it was a year after that conference that President Dwight D. Eisenhower delivered his speech, also named Atoms for Peace, which he delivered to the UN, which was the first time that the topic of atomic energy had been like brought up in that context of like the UN.
He was actually just talking about a group of guys named Adam who were like, peace, man.
But basically his speech, probably, I'm guessing, from the conference, yeah, was aimed to spread the idea that the atomic dilemma, quote unquote, could be solved by finding ways to make it a contributor in saving people's lives. Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, like, if you make this technology less scary, it's less of a big deal. Which I'm like, eh, like, I understand maybe being like, hey, like, atomic energy has its uses, but, like, the atomic bomb is scary.
Yeah, and here's the thing. The atomic bomb has a very specific and singular purpose.
So I'm like, Dwight, I don't agree with you.
Well, it's like any other weapon, you know. Yes, it depends on how you use it, but at the end of the day, that thing is designed to do one thing, and that is to cause harm.
Right, exactly. So after her conference and not return to Egypt, she received what is known as the Fulbright Scholarship in Atomic Radiation, which basically invited her to research at the University of California, Berkeley, which she accepted. She's like, heck yeah, I'm going to go do that. And she was so widely recognized for her talents in the field that she was given permission to visit the secret U.S. atomic facilities, which had never been offered to a non-U.S. citizen ever.
That fucking blows my mind.
Yeah, so the fact that they offered that to her, like, there was a ton of debate among, like, academics and the scientific circles and basically anyone that found out she was allowed to do it.
Yeah.
There was a ton of argument around it because they were like, well, what makes her so special?
For a woman, a foreign woman.
A foreign non-white woman.
Foreign woman of color, yep. From Egypt to go into these top secret U.S. military atomic sites.
Yep.
I can't imagine it happening today.
No.
I cannot.
No. Not without, like, incredible security clearance. You know what I mean? Like, it would have to be, like,
I feel like
top government official from a different country, not just, oh, I'm a scientist with a PhD.
Yeah. And actually, even now, I don't even know how much the public would be allowed to know because, like, the U.S.
public. Well, the debate wasn't in public. It was among the academics.
I know, but I know people lose their fucking minds.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So she got to do that.
Even an American citizen born of Egyptian parents, exactly. Like people would be losing their shit.
But yeah, so it was a really big deal that she got to do this, and she did it.
Yep.
And like while she was there and while she was studying, she got a lot of offers that were like, hey, like come work with us, come, you know, like teach at our school and all this stuff. And she turned down all of them because she did not want to live in the United States. Not because it was the United States, but because she would say, quote, Egypt, my dear homeland is waiting for me. She's like, I want to go home. Here's where things get weird.
Yeah.
Literally, that's what my notes say. Here's where things get weird. So there's a lot of mystery, controversy, rumors.
Conspiracy.
Speculation, conspiracy theories. There's just a lot of stuff that went on around her death.
Cosas.
Like, even as far as, like, where she died, because most people are like, she died in California, but then, like, Wikipedia is like, she died in Wyoming, but Wikipedia actually links to like 7 news articles, like pulled from the papers. And mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, I think she died in Wyoming.
See, and this is interesting because I think I remember she died in California. So again, I think this is a testament to how weird this next part of the story is.
Well, it could be like, the reason people say she died in California is because she was living in California mm-hmm. at the time, but she was on a trip.
Yeah.
So technically her residency when she died was California.
Yeah.
So anyways, so there are several versions of what may or may not have happened when she died. And I kind of like included several of them just to kind of like give people a flavor of what's out there. So what we know, what the facts are, is that she died in a car crash.
Yep.
Somewhere on the West Coast.
There was a car, there was a road.
There was a car not negative, on the road.
There was, God damn it.
And she died.
That's oh
my
God.
That's what we know for certain. So, also, it sounds like she was basically done with her research, and this was some sort of trip prior to returning to Egypt. Mm-hmm. What the meaning or purpose of that trip was is also up for debate. So one of the things that was told is was that she had received an invitation for dinner and was driving along the Pacific coast when the car swerved, plummeted 40 feet over the edge, killing her immediately. So the car swerving, plummeting 40 feet over the edge, and her dying on impact, that is the only probably 100% factual. Actually, even her dying on impact, we don't know 100%.
Yeah.
The car crashed.
The car went off the road.
So in this version of events, supposedly the driver jumped from the car just before the fall and later disappeared. And then it turned out the invitation that she had received for dinner was fake. And yep. So that's one of the things. And some people say that, you know, maybe she was a target of Mossad, which is Israel's intelligence agency, mainly to prevent Egypt from acquiring knowledge of America's nuclear technology. Mossad has never claimed responsibility, which a lot of times when they, not a lot of times, sometimes when they assassinate people, they actually do. They'll be like, yeah, we definitely did that. Yeah.
I'm just going to say,
this is one theory though.
It is not, I know it looks very easy in movies. It is not easy for a driver to jump out of a car mm-hmm. right before it plummets off of a cliff. Mm-hmm. I assume, though, that they must have found her in the passenger seat, which implies there was a driver who was not found. So that part's weird.
But see, that's where it gets weird.
Okay, it gets weirder.
It really is depending on the source. Because in all the articles that Wikipedia lists, because I went through, like, all of them. Because I'm like, why is Wikipedia so different? Like,
Kelly's true crime brain was going.
This is why I was late for work this morning.
It was popping off.
And like, I was like, okay, well, yeah, why does it say Wyoming and blah, 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 blah. So this one has a lot more details and specific dates because this is the one that, yeah, like you can actually go and find newspaper articles.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the most likely version. And I'm not saying it's 100% factually accurate. So this version is that Samira died in a car crash near Sheridan, Wyoming on August 15th, 1952, while traveling on vacation. She was riding passenger in a 1952 Buick sedan, with the driver being Arling Owen Kressler, who was a U.S. Air Force civilian employee, basically, like, assigned to travel with her.
Okay.
Their car lost control and fell 54 feet into a 30-foot ravine. Both died at the scene, and arrangements were made to send her body back to Cairo by air. And the newspaper clippings talked a lot about how, like, they found both of their bodies.
Okay.
And he had papers on him indicating who he was, and she had papers on her indicating who she was, and that's how people know.
I will say, faking a car accident is actually, I think, a lot harder and more complicated than people think it is. Especially if you're, like, on a winding road and the car plummets and there's no other signs of, you know, injury. There's no gun or anything like that. I think because of her involvement in nuclear technology and atomic technology.
That's what adds in the, like.
Well, and her uniqueness as an Egyptian woman who was allowed access to American secrets. Like, here's the thing. It does sound sus. I totally get that. But at the end of the day, I think it is probably more likely that it was a car crash and it was tragic and it was just fucking awful.
Funny that, like, people just go to these extremes that, like, someone paid, like, a person to drive this car and drive it off the cliff, but somehow jump out at the last minute. I'm like, really? They couldn't have just, like, cut the brakes?
Yeah. Also, like, to be perfectly honest, if someone was going to send her in a car off of a cliff, they wouldn't even be in the driver's seat. They would just
tell her to drive herself.
Honestly, I would have to see, like, the exact site make, because I'm kind of imagining, like,
a very
two-lane curvy road, not just, like, a cliff where you can set everything up. Like, are there, are there brake, are there, like, scratch, not scratch, what am I thinking of? The tire marks?
Yeah.
You know, what's the word for that? It's not scratch or scratch or...
Tire tracks?
No, but, you know, it's like when you try to stop and it leaves the black line. There's a specific
streaks?
Word for it.
Oh. I have no idea what you're trying to say.
Anyway, but there's no marks from the tires of, like, maybe attempting to stop the
car. That's why I was like, maybe they cut the brakes.
Like, there's a lot of unknowns, but I think just odds are it was a tragic accident.
Yeah.
And whenever someone who's, like, important or prominent dies, it's we're rife with conspiracy theories. If she was
no one
would be questioning it. All right, let's hear it. Let's hear it.
So the last one is very similar to the first in that, yeah, she was, this time instead of having a dinner invitation, she was invited to visit a nuclear plant, and they sent a car for her, so she, you know, was on that. And then on this one, another car appeared and, like, ran them off the road. But again, it was the driver jumped out and disappeared and stuff like that. And on this one, it says she died soon after. And I'm like, okay, what?
Skid marks. That's what I was trying to think of. It begins with an S.
And then, like, supposedly the invitation from the plant never existed and blah, 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 blah. So those are the, like, three major theories.
Yeah.
All we know is that she died in a car crash. Very tragic.
I was going to say, regardless, it's tragic and it's awful. Yes. And the world lost out.
Yes. A year later, in 1953, the Egyptian army honored her and she was awarded the Order of Merit for Science and Art, first class. She has a school and a laboratory in her home village named after her.
Oh.
In 1981, no, not that one. Sorry. Oh, there's a cultural landmark in where she, like, in the village she was born that was placed as part of Egyptians' Women Day. On what year? Could not find, but it exists. There was an Egyptian TV series titled The Immortal Dramatizing Her Life.
Which I'm kind of like, I kind of want to watch. I do kind of love that.
And then in 2000, there was a book published that covered like her life and scientific contributions. And yeah, like just the fact that she was so widely well known and respected really opened the doors for a lot of other Egyptian women in STEM, because up until this point, STEM fields in Middle Eastern countries have been notoriously closed to women.
Yeah.
And still are.
Middle Eastern, African, yeah. I mean,
yeah, really outside of like
even in the
Western
States,
Europe.
Let's
better.
Be honest. It is, but
like
yes.
Western Europe and the United States are slightly better.
Yeah.
But yeah, like this did open doors to be like, okay, yeah, like look at what kind of like we talked about in your story last week, like look at what women can accomplish.
I do really love that Egypt has embraced her.
Very much so.
You know, that's really nice to see, because we have covered women where their country of origin either forgets them or purposely erases them.
Or just doesn't do anything. You know, like it's kind of like a neutral.
But they definitely, they were like, we claim her. Like she's our daughter.
Exactly.
We love her.
So that was the retelling. I'm going to hate myself forever. Of Samir Musa.
I love it. Samira Musa 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Unless I convince you just to never publish this episode and then no one ever hears
No,
it.
Because I'm really excited for my story. And again, I
mean, it's not that we wouldn't tell your story. It would be we would re-record.
I think that her story is worth repeating. I had a lot of fun talking about some of the theories. I kind of want to go back and listen to 157 and see like what the differences are, because I feel like I learned new stuff during your telling. Also,
I still feel terrible about
also
it.
5 years. It took us 5 years for this to happen. I'm
That's
so
why
excited.
I'm so mad.
Honestly.
Because 157, that wouldn't even be 5 years. It would be like 2, maybe. I'm going to go look when 157 was published.
I don't think you need to beat yourself up too much.
I'm going to. I don't care.
Okay. Well, Kelly beats
Don't tell me what to do, Emily.
Well, Kelly beats herself up. We're going to offer you an alternative by talking about, you know, therapy, online therapy for your feelings.
Hey, guys. We know times have been tough lately for all of us.
And during hard times, it can be difficult if you don't have anyone to talk to, or it can be hard to talk about certain topics.
Being alone with your thoughts can be isolating. This is why we are sponsored by BetterHelp.
BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who are trained to listen to and help you.
Talk to your therapist in a private online environment at your convenience.
BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. So you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. Thank goodness.
There's a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's 20,000 plus therapist network that gives you access to the help that may not be available in your area.
You just fill out a questionnaire to help assess your specific needs, and then you get matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. That is Amazon fast. Then you schedule secure video and phone sessions. Plus, you can exchange unlimited messages, and everything you share is completely confidential, just like with an in-person therapist.
You can request a new therapist at any time at no additional charges. If you want to talk to someone about your mental health, you can get a 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/herstory. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/herstory.
Okay, Kelly, are you done?
Nope.
Self-hurting?
August 15th, your brain. 2022. So it's been like a year and a half. Not even.
Dude, I don't even. 2022 feels like a million years ago. I was actually thinking about it because I touch on Roe v. Wade in my story. I'm like, oh my God, when did that go overturn? Oh my God, that like it doesn't feel like it was that long ago. What the fuck? Because that was 2022. All right. Well. Kelly, you can just sit back and feel your feelings.
And cry silently to myself.
You know what, though? After I tell you my story, if you still feel bad for yourself, you might actually just be a bad person. Because in comparison,
that's up for debate anyway.
In comparison, so. Your life is going real well. So today, I am covering Anne Green.
Why does that name sound familiar?
Not Anne of Green Gables.
That's just not what I said, Emily.
Anne Green. No, I know, but that's what I thought of when I first heard it. Okay, so
tell me about Anne Green.
Anne Green never set out to become famous or infamous, depending on who you ask. In fact, she likely would have preferred to have been lost to history, but due to a series of tragic, frustrating, and fucking absurd events, Anne has secured her place in history and in our hearts. Anne Green was born in Steeple Barton, Oxfordshire, England, sometime around 1628. So we're going back to the 1600s. Sweet 1600s, maybe not so sweet, as yeah. We're going to find out. She was of the, you know, I was trying to think, there's that old saying where it's like nothing good happens after 1 a.m.
Yes.
or 2 a.m. or whatever. And after I'm like, it. Nothing good happens after the 1500s or before. Nothing happens after 00000.1. It's a lot. So she was of the working class, which is evidenced by her work as a scullery maid, employed in the house of Sir Thomas Reed, a justice of the peace. Peaceful and just like he was not. Throw it out there. So being a scullery maid was the lowest ranking servant position, often occupied by young women or girls, and it involved... It was like doing all the shit work. So it involved.
No, it is. It's like the kitchen work and everything other people don't want to do.
Yeah, it was assisting the kitchen maid, and it was tough work. And Anne completed the most physically demanding, dirtiest, and worst chores that no one else wanted to do, including scouring plates, pots, sinks, stoves, and floors, plucking fowl, and scaling fish.
Sounds fun.
Though the work was hard, it was work, and perhaps Anne would have eventually moved up the ranks within the house. At this point, she's like in her early 20s.
Okay.
So she's young. Enter Geoffrey Reed. It's Jeffrey,
yeah,
but it's spelled in the worst way possible. Geoffrey Reed, Sir Thomas Reed's grandson. So everywhere I read read the story, it said that Anne was quote-unquote seduced by Jeffrey. But...
we all know what that means.
I take issue with that word. So there is an inherent imbalance of power in the situation with Jeffrey. I'm just going to call him Joffrey because I don't like him. I don't care about him. Joffrey being the grandson of Anne's employer and of a higher social standing than her. So we're never going to know the true relationship of the true nature of their relationship. I think at best we can say it was inherently problematic.
Yeah.
But what we do know is that Anne became pregnant.
Oh.
The next section of this, I'm putting in a trigger warning for miscarriage and birth trauma. Anne would discover the pregnancy in an incredibly traumatic way. Several weeks into the pregnancy, Anne became sick and ran to the privy, where she suffered a miscarriage. The fetus, which was no bigger than her hand, could have never sustained life on its own, and it was truly a shock to Anne, who didn't even realize she was pregnant. Can you imagine? Anne was completely shocked and horrified. She knew the significant consequences of becoming pregnant out of wedlock by her employer's grandson, who was of a higher station than her. I can only begin to imagine the panic she felt because before this traumatic miscarriage, she didn't even realize she was pregnant.
Yeah.
Not knowing what else to do, Anne hid the remains of the fetus. And like,
makes sense, yeah.
This is a horrifying thought, but I really want to reiterate that the fetus could have never sustained life outside of Anne. It actually was not alive, period.
Yeah.
And miscarriages can happen for a million different reasons. They are tragic events, and Anne was not responsible for it. And what she did in trying to hide the miscarriage was out of panic and self-preservation. It was not out of cruelty or callousness or disregard. She's like 20 years old.
She's panicking.
There are so many social implications to this. And as we're going to find out, there are also a lot of serious legal complications. So while Anne was not responsible for the miscarriage, according to the laws of 2024, sorry, the 1600s, she was 100% responsible. There was this little thing called the Concealment of Birth of Bastards Act of 1624. This act stipulated that any woman who tried to conceal the death of an illegitimate child must be assumed to have murdered the child.
Jesus Christ.
Like, okay, first of all, don't even get me started about the idea of an illegitimate child. We're going to go back to the two mother and baby homes. I'm going to start screaming. I cannot fucking even. But then this idea that a child born not under the was deemed right. The socially respectable circumstances, if that child dies,
automatically the mother's fault.
First of all, there are so many social and economic consequences to something like that. But so if a mother tries to conceal that death, or even like, I mean, even if they're just trying to conceal the fact that they'd had an illegitimate child, because again, the social consequences are very unforgiving. Oh, no. By default, you murdered them.
Yeah.
Let's just take a moment and think of all the ways that a child, regardless of their birth circumstances, may die in the 1600s. And then let's add on.
We're gonna be here for a while.
Yeah. Then let's add the social and economic consequences to women of having an illegitimate child, let alone a child who doesn't survive for whatever reason. So no matter what the circumstances, if that child was illegitimate, the mother could be tried for murder.
That's insane.
And I imagine that this thought was also running through the panicking Anne's mind. So again, like, this isn't just, what will people think of me? It's, oh my God.
What do I do?
I don't even want to think about it. And again, she's like in her early 20s. Like, she's so young. She hasn't even had time to think about this. Like, at the same time that she's dealing with this miscarriage, she's also coming to the realization that she was pregnant in the first place.
Yeah.
By her boss's grandson. Unfortunately for her, Sir Thomas Reed found out about the miscarriage and was determined to have Anne prosecuted. So, apparently, like, another servant saw her trying to conceal the fetus and told on her. And I'm like, fuck you.
Yeah.
Fuck you. And what of Joffrey, who was also responsible for the pregnancy? No fucking idea, actually. We never hear about him ever again. And he's never expected to take responsibility. Because, again, the onus of any of this kind of thing, illegitimate children, raising them, like anything, it's all on the woman.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Anne was tried for murder. She spent 3 weeks, quote, in continual affrights and terror in the Oxford jail before her trial. I feel so bad for her. This is hell. And this is a hell that she has just suddenly found herself in. She's had no time to process or think about this. It's just happening to her. At her trial, several witnesses and experts testified on Anne's behalf. A midwife confirmed that the fetus was too small and underdeveloped to have ever been alive. So, like, regardless of what happened, there was no, like, it just,
the viability was not there.
It was sad. It was tragic. There was, like, she did not hurt this fetus.
Yeah.
There was just no way it could have been alive or survived outside of her. Exactly. Several other servants also testified to the hard labor that Anne's job required and the fact that she was actually experiencing issues and pain prior to the miscarriage due to that labor. There was something like she was mixing, oh God, what's the stuff in beer that begins with an M?
Malt?
Malt. Yeah, she was like stirring malt and she had a, she like had a lot of pain and sickness and weakness after that. And that is not an easy thing. Mm-hmm. And again, she doesn't even know she's pregnant. But again, even if she knew she was pregnant and everyone knew she was pregnant, she would still be having you do that hard labor. Yeah. It's not her fault. And again, there's no way to prove that that kind of thing could have caused the miscarriage and therefore it could have been prevented. Again, miscarriages can happen for a million different reasons. We all know someone who has suffered a miscarriage, even if you don't know it.
Yeah. The percentage of women that have had miscarriages is huge.
It's so much more common than people think because we don't talk about it. So despite all of this evidence to the contrary, Anne was found guilty of murder with the assumption that she'd undergone an abortion. They're like, well, the reason that the fetus was so small and couldn't sustain life is because you forcibly aborted it. And she was sentenced to death.
That's extreme.
Let's all take a moment to remember that the act that allowed for this was passed in 1624, and that today in 2024, women can still be found guilty for murder for having a miscarriage. But hey, it's only been 400 years. These things take time. Christ. Anne was sentenced to be hanged on December 14th, 1650 at Oxford Castle. Now, hanging is not a pretty way to go. But in the 1600s...
It's not even a guaranteed way to go.
In the 1600s, it was somehow worse. It was even more of a shit show. Instead of being dropped from a scaffold and like having the rope specifically measured to snap your neck, victims were actually pulled off the ground by the rope around their neck and then just left to slowly suffocate. Which...
That's super inhumane.
Fucking God. Because of this, death was long, painful, and torturous. And to hasten her death, Anne actually asked family and friends to pull and yank hard on the rope in hopes of breaking her neck and killing her faster.
I would probably request the same thing.
Can you imagine, though, like, being someone close to her and her asking you, like, hey, I'm going to be executed wrongfully.
I need you to help me.
I need you to help kill me faster. This is all like some kind of nightmarish fever dream.
Oh, yeah.
They complied, pulling on the rope, hanging off of her legs, and a soldier even beat her with the butt of his musket to try and hasten her death. And after 30 minutes, Anne was presumed dead and cut down. That was still 30 minutes of them actively trying to kill her. However, she was still breathing.
Oh my God.
According to accounts, quote, a lusty fellow who stood by thinking to do an act of charity and riding her out of the small relics of a painful life.
Sorry, what? Repeat that sentence.
A lusty fellow who stood by thinking to do an act of charity by ridding her out of the small relics of a painful life.
What does any of that even mean?
Well, we're going to find out. He began stomping on her chest and stomach until they were sure she was dead. So basically, he was like, she's practically dead. She's just suffering. I'm going to hasten that process. So he was trying to put her out of her misery.
I don't know if I believe that. This sounds like a guy who's just like, you know what? Fuck this. I'm going to use this as an excuse.
I'm just going to stomp on this poor lady. But the idea was that, you know, she was hoping for a quick death. Death was inevitable. And because she was still alive when they cut her down, he was like, okay, she's suffering and slowly dying. Let me just try and put
that
her.
Sounds
no,
terrible.
It's awful. Don't get me wrong. It is fucking awful. So at this time, it was common practice for bodies of criminals to be used for medical studies.
Yep.
So Anne's body was placed in a coffin and taken to the University of Oxford to be dissected and studied. Now, this is normally where the story would end. But doctors William Petty and Thomas Willis planned on dissecting Anne's body for one of their lectures. However, when they opened Anne's coffin, quote, She was observed to breathe, and in breathing, obscurely to rattle. And her body was unusually warm, you know, for someone who was dead.
Supposedly. Allegedly.
Allegedly. Accounts of her death have been widely exaggerated.
Yeah.
Everyone was shocked. And to their credit, Petty and Willis began to administer first aid.
Good.
Or at least the 1600s version of it. This is the most fucking insane shit. I like part of me kind of wants all of this because it sounds like a fun time if I wasn't like half dead. Oh, no, he's just mostly dead.
Yeah.
So this included, and I listed these from least absurd to most, rubbing her limbs, applying a, I should have looked up how I pronounce it, poultice to her breast. Yeah, which is like a wet cloth with like medicinal oil. And, you know, just it's like a giant. I got the sense it was like a giant hot Vicks Vapo rub. It was it was like a heating pad mixed with Vicks. It was supposed to stimulate you. Pouring hot cordial down her throat.
Ooh, I like that one.
I love that. Okay. Heating pad, Vicks, people rubbing me, warm, like a hot toddy. I'm fucking here for this. Can I get this done without all the pre-death? this is the part I don't like as much. Bloodletting.
Yep.
And
what?
I'm sorry. I'm choking because I started laughing. Administering a tobacco smoke enema. I guess it's gonna wake you the fuck up.
Yeah, it is.
Jesus. I'm sorry. Okay, I'm dying.
Hold while I'm
it's
dying.
Fine.
Yeah. Don't worry, I'll try some of these on her, guys.
And this is my favorite. Putting her in bed with a warm woman who rubbed her to keep her toasty. Honestly, most of this sounds like a great time. I'm here for
it. Yeah, right? Like, I'm down.
And in perhaps the most shocking twist of this entire batshit story, the butt smoke warm rub lady treatment worked. And within 12 hours, Anne was speaking. And after Jesus. 4 days, she was able to eat solid food. And within a month, Anne fully recovered from the horrific and determined attempts to kill her.
Jesus Christ.
After, like, when you hear everything they did to hasten her death, and even, like, when they cut her down, that dude, like,
stomping,
like,
on
jumped
her.
Up and down on her fucking body, and then she was in a coffin until they, like, opened it up to dissect her, and she was still alive the whole time. And then they were able to revive her full. It's absolutely.
It's a fucking miracle.
It is. Batshit insane. Mercifully, Anne's only side effect was that she didn't remember the attempted execution.
That's good.
Thank God. Can you imagine?
No.
Can you imagine, like, waking up and remembering your friends and family pulling on your legs and ropes and just being like, die already! And then some guy ghetto stomping your chest. Oh my God.
I feel like I shouldn't be laughing at this.
No, it's because it is so fucking insane.
Yeah.
Because this wasn't just, well, they choked her out with a rope for a little bit. And like, I guess they didn't check to see if they were alive. Like they really fucking tried to kill her.
Yeah, they did.
A lot of people put in a lot of effort and from a loving place too, to kill her. Oh my God. But Anne's troubles were not over. There was still the little issue of her having been sentenced to death and her insistence on living. Fortunately, though, for Anne, the leading force behind her being tried and sentenced to death in the first place, Sir Thomas Reed, had died 3 days after Anne's failed hanging.
Nice.
Fuck you, sir.
Right?
You are not peaceful and you have no justice. So when the God-fearing authorities determined that Anne had been saved by the providence of God, and therefore that proved her innocence, there was no one to argue otherwise. They're like, okay, well, the only guy who wanted her dead is dead. Fucking dead. Also, he died 3 days after her botched hanging. So that's also God saying, fuck that dude.
Exactly.
And like, here's the thing.
I think we can just let it go, guys.
I don't give a lot of credence to this, like, well, obviously God wanted this. This is one of those stories where I'm like, what's up, God? He's like, just chilling up there? Should we have a conversation? Like, it's so poetic.
Yeah.
So Anne moved to the country with friends, and because she's the baddest fucking bitch that ever lived, and she's goth as hell, she took her coffin with her.
Fuck yeah.
I would too!
Also, coffins were back then were like, one, like fitted to you, and two, super expensive. I mean, they're still super expensive.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how bougie hers would have been.
I don't because care, it was, I would still take it with me.
I mean, I would too. At the very least, you could burn it for warmth. Or save it for when you actually die.
That's what
die.
I was saying. Like, I would save it to when I actually die.
I think I would.
Fuckers are expensive.
I think I would almost keep it as like a talisman. Like, as long as I have this coffin, I'm not going to be murdered.
Little shelves on the inside and just make it like some thing in
it's
your
a,
house.
It, maybe it's like a little playpen for your kiddos. I don't know.
No, that's too much.
Okay. You know what, Kelly? Maybe you're just not as metal as I am.
Clearly.
So, she would eventually marry and have three children, who she may or may not have put in the coffin playpen. She lived another 15 years before dying in 1665, presumably of natural causes.
Presumably.
You know, she was only in her early 20s when all this went down. She only lived another 15 years. That still feels
young.
Awfully young. This is the 1600s, though.
That's true.
So I'm just going to...
still, that's like... our age.
Yeah. No, it's gross. It's sad. It's really sad.
Yeah, it's not gross.
Like, after everything she went through, that being said, another 15 years after everything she went through.
The fact that she, like, was stomped on.
The fact that she lived another fucking day is pretty miraculous. But yeah, she lived to have three children. You know, she lived the rest of her life, hopefully in peace. So, legacy. Anne's story was recorded in and shared through pamphlets, including one titled, and I fucking love this, News from the Dead, or A True and Exact Narration of the Miraculous Deliverance of Anne Green.
I liked your arm movement.
It sounds like one of those like old sci-fi movie titles where it's like News from the Dead, or alternative title, something more specific, because we want to get your attention.
Right.
We want to get your attention away from your marbles or your stick in a hoop.
Stick in a hoop.
Stick in a hoop, stick in a hoop. It's better than spending your time taking a poop. Stick in a hoop. All right. But what is, serious time, real talk. What is truly chilling about Anne's story is that this could totally happen today.
Oh, yeah.
With the overturning of Roe versus Wade, not only is healthcare being restricted for Americans, but states are passing laws that would hold people criminally responsible for miscarriages or any unsuccessful pregnancy, regardless of the circumstances. On December 4th, 2018, which I will note is before the overturning of Roe v. Wade, Marsha Jones, who was 5 months pregnant, was shot by a coworker outside of a Dollar General in Pleasant Grove, Alabama. While Marsha survived the attack, fortunately,
which is insane.
I honestly can't believe that the bullet tragically entered her abdomen, causing a miscarriage. And like, she's 5 months pregnant. She wants this child. She has every intention of carrying it to term, and she's shot, and she suffers a miscarriage. Truly awful. As if this situation couldn't be more tragic, Marsha was charged with manslaughter.
Of course.
By the state of Alabama.
God damn it, Alabama.
No, I mean, I'm like, oh, fucking Alabama. That being said, I don't want to just be like, well, Alabama. Like, this could happen anywhere. In this specific case, goddammit, Alabama. But they're not special. No, they're not unique. So the state of Alabama argued that she had knowingly put the fetus in danger and therefore was responsible for the miscarriage.
I knew my coworker was going to come and shoot me.
Yeah.
I knew that was going to happen and I just let it happen.
It's like, oh yeah. I told her, I put my arms out and I said, please shoot my pregnant belly.
Right. God damn it.
It's absolutely disgusting that you can be the victim of gun violence.
Shooting?
Yeah. And don't even get me fucking started on guns. Like, oh my God. So this marked the first instance in Alabama that a pregnant person was charged for suffering a miscarriage. And this wasn't even a miscarriage that, like, miscarriages can happen.
Yeah.
Because, full stop, they can just happen. It's not something you did or didn't do. It can just happen because in this case, she was literally shot.
Right. Like,
proven to be shot.
It was literally not her fault in any way.
Yeah. We know what caused the miscarriage, and it was another person shooting her, and she was still charged with, manslaughter.
Which is insane.
So fortunately the case was ultimately dismissed. There was a lot of, I remember this because there was national outrage. It was like, this is the Handmaid's dystopian future that we've been worried about. And it's fucking happening. Are you goddamn kidding me?
Right.
Like, if you can be charged, if you can be found criminally responsible for a miscarriage when you have been shot by another person, what the hell is going to happen when you suffer a miscarriage for literally any other reason?
Yeah.
The woman who shot Marche was also brought up on manslaughter charges, but due to Alabama stand your ground law, she was not indicted. So nothing happened to anyone.
Are you kidding me?
Even the person who fucking shot her was not held responsible for this.
That's insane.
I'm screaming.
Oh yeah. Like, are you like, how backwards does that have to be that like you can shoot someone and get away with it?
Yeah.
But you lose a child that you want.
Yeah, and you're held criminally
responsible. Because you got shot,
yep.
Which you did not want, and you are criminally responsible.
Yep. I also want to point out, Marche is a Black woman.
Yeah.
So I just want to say, like, there's layers of discrimination
and
prejudice
going on.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Bullshit.
So we like to think that ultimately things get better, but right now things are factually becoming increasingly dangerous for Americans, particularly women and those who can get pregnant. The story of Anne Green, who was sentenced to death for suffering a miscarriage in the 1600s,
is way too relevant.
It just hits so frighteningly close. And as absurd as her story is and as wild as it is, it brings up a lot of issues that still affect us today. And I am personally horrified and disgusted that a story from the 1600s has any relevance, has any relevance to our discussion today.
Right. And so, you can like literally like almost make a one-to-one comparison. It's gross.
Yeah. I mean,
sad and frustrating.
Well, and nowadays, in Anne's situation, it would probably be easier to find her criminally responsible because it was.
She tried to hide it.
Well, it was a miscarriage. It was a miscarriage that wasn't caused by being publicly attacked by another person with a weapon.
But also, you're more likely to be brought up on criminal charges if you try to hide it.
Yeah, but if you don't try to hide it, you can be brought.
Exactly.
I'm saying
it's both sides.
Well, and I'm saying in this case, Anne, I mean, it was actually in her best interest to try and hide it.
Yeah.
Like she was put in the position where she had to choose between gambling or trying to just move on from this trauma.
Yeah.
And actually, if no one had found out,
it would have been fine.
I'm not saying she would have been fine, but none of this would have happened.
Criminally, she would have been fine. I wasn't saying like mentally or emotionally. 100%.
Yeah. So, yeah, I heard this story on a podcast recently, and I loved it because, one, it was just so insane. It was kind of like one of those crazy, like, what the fuck stories that I really wanted to cover, but also it just has a lot of relevance. And there's, you know, there's this new legislation or this new ruling about whether preserved embryos for IVF. And like, I'm just saying, this shit is so slippery. And
we're like, on a track of potentially very dangerous.
And I don't care who you are or how safe you think you are. We are all in danger.
Yeah.
So.
Maybe not men. But women.
If they care about the people in their lives.
Yeah, exactly.
If they care about anyone else in the world. Yeah.
And some of them don't.
I mean, then they suck. And
I mean, yes.
That's a different issue.
But that's how we ended up where we are.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. We end up where we are is because the people making these decisions they're always going to have access to that healthcare. The women in their lives, the people in their lives who can get pregnant are always going to have access to that healthcare.
Or they have the money.
Yeah.
That if they got into the situation that these women get into, it doesn't matter because they have the money to get out of it.
Yeah. And it's always going to be the most vulnerable, the most marginalized people who suffer the most.
Yep. It's a bunch of bullshit.
But that is the story of Anne Green, the Resurrection Queen.
I mean, yeah.
I was very proud of that. Anne Green, the Resurrection Queen.
Yeah, how long did it take you?
Not that long, actually. Good. I was trying to figure out if I could find like something that I wrote in the notes, but no, Resurrection Queen just really, really fit, and it rhymes. It's like Marceline the Vampire Queen, Anne Green the Resurrection Queen.
I mean, it's because, yeah, Green and Queen.
I typed it into my rhyming dictionary while I was coming up with the intro.
You and your rhyming dictionary.
So, Kelly, what are you thankful for?
Right now, not a whole lot, because God damn it.
Are you thankful you're not Anne Green?
I mean, yeah.
At the very least.
I do not want to be stomped by a lusty man.
A lusty man.
I have so many questions for that reporter.
I feel like, I'm like, did lusty mean what it means
probably
today?
Probably not.
Like, I think it just meant like a hefty.
Burly.
It was a hefty gentleman.
And like,
who's a hefty guy?
Can I pretend to die and you give me some of those treatments from the 16th century?
I don't know if I want tobacco smoke up my butt because I worry about the carcinogens.
But some of those other ones,
the warm woman and the warm alcohol and the rubbing and
massages, like all of that sounds good.
That sounds really good.
I am thankful for the opportunity to do a live show again. And hopefully by this time, it has gone well.
There's no way to know.
At the time of the recording, there is no way for us to know.
We are simultaneously.
We are our own Schrodinger's cat.
Yeah. As we're recording this, it has not happened. By the time it releases, it will have happened. You're probably going to know how it went because our Instagram is either going to be celebratory or burnt to the ground.
I mean, I already want to burn it to the ground because of my fuck up tonight.
You know what? I loved it though, because here's the thing. You said her name. I didn't even remember that I covered her. Like, we've covered so many women on this podcast in our 5 fucking years. Sometimes it's hard to remember all of their stories, all of their names in detail. And so having that reminder, I feel like I'm not going to forget Samira.
I still feel like I want to die.
I feel like
I want to go hide in a corner somewhere.
Well, you can do it after this.
I mean, yeah, that's the plan. I'm going to go to bed.
Shit.
What are you thankful for?
What am I thankful for? Oh my God. I mean, I honestly, I'm thankful for a lot. A few little things.
I have been able to actually have like small conversations with my Spanish speaking coworkers at the hotel, which has been cool, where it's like, oh my God, I'm actually starting to piece this shit together, where I can not only understand what people are saying to me, but then respond. And I'm not saying my responses are great or necessarily accurate, but I'm getting my point across in my broken way. But yeah, no, I actually had like a whole conversation about like what I had done that week and how many hours I work and like this and that with one of my coworkers. And that was cool. I am also thankful that some homeowners I worked with for work got some really good news. Yay. I'm super thankful for, because I've been thinking about them a lot and just hoping everything works out. I am very thankful for Kelly watching my cheese. My little cheese, who I'm going to go snuggle because I love him so much. No, I'm feeling very thankful for the people in my life. I'm feeling very thankful for where I am. I'm very thankful for my fella for going on that little weekend trip with me for my birthday and just like totally leaning into my shenanigans.
All the shit.
And like not even like he was going along with it. He was into it. Yeah, it was amazing. So
good. I'm glad.
Yeah. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of Whining About Herstory that hopefully wasn't too depressing. Like us on Facebook at Whining About Herstory, Instagram at WAHPad.
Not our Twitter. We don't have Twitter or X or whatever.
I think we technically have it, but I do not use it. I do not give a shit. I barely gave a shit when it was Twitter.
Our website is whiningaboutherstory.com, where you can find a link to all of our social medias, as well as a link to anywhere you want to listen, and a link to our merch, which is pretty damn sweet.
Merch.
Hashtag StemFem.
Love to make StemFem. If you're a stuff. Karen who's not problematic, we've got some fucking merch for you.
That too.
Hashtag never our Karen. Our Karen would never.
I
hope she actually listens to this.
Of course Karen will listen to this. It might just be like 3 months from now. It's fine. Also, you can find a link to our Buy Me a Coffee, where you can buy a bottle of wine for us for as little as $5. It's a one-time purchase. Or you can donate to our Patreon for as little as $1 a month to get some extra content.
Check out our most recent Herstory Happening about ads targeting women and the absolute roller coaster that it was.
It was a time.
Kelly threw her head back and curled her toes. It was so much. It was everything.
It was
all the things.
In the best way.
It was all about version of her. God damn it. Also, rate us 5 stars wherever you listen, because it pisses off a misogynist.
Yeah, basically.
And supports a small woman-run business during Women's History Month, which, let's be honest, you could do more of that. We all could.
Yeah, accurate.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Whining About Herstory. I'm Emily.
I'm Kelly.
Have an empowered day, y'all.
Bye.
And good virginal hearth to all. Good virginal hearth to all, and to all a good virginal hearth.